The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Why work harder when you can work smarter? I mean, we're all looking for ways to make work and life just a little bit easier. Enter the Ford F-150 truck. It helps you get the job done in the smartest way possible. Have you seen the Pro Access tailgate? It improves access to the bed and cargo, which makes it easier to load in tight spaces. Think about the time and hassle you'll save with that feature alone. And I haven't even mentioned the mobile power source, Pro Power On Board. You can power up to 7.2 kilowatts outside your F-150. You're already thinking about all the ways you can put that to use, aren't you? See, I told you, smarter. Tough this smart can only be called F-150. Find your local Ford dealer at Ford.com. Pro Access tailgate available starting spring 2024. See owner's manual for important operating instructions.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And today we've got former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. He's talking about his political career, how he got started, what it was like running for president and campaigning this year, and why he threw his support behind Joe Biden. Andrew's also talking about the work he just started doing as an advisor to Biden. And of course, we're going to talk about another issue that Andrew's really been vocal about, the way WWE treats talent. He's got a lot of thoughts on that and some ideas on how to change it. He's also a huge wrestling fan, talks about some of his favorite performers, shows, and matches. We'll hit on social media and why Andrew thinks that needs to be regulated to some degree. He'll explain his idea for universal income and the pilot program he's running in upstate New York. Interesting stuff with Andrew Yang, just in time for the U.S. presidential election. Andrew Yang is coming up. Let's just jump right into it, man. So,
Let me record locally just as a backup.
I'm
like a courteous guest.
Thank you, man. I've been screwed a couple times by technology over the last few months. It's crazy. As good as things are, you miss that record button or don't download in time or whatever, you lose everything.
Yeah, agree. So yeah, recording. It's great to be here. I'm on Chris Jericho's podcast. Yes.
We've been talking about this for a long time.
Yeah, I'm sorry it took so long. The campaign trail was bananas. And at some point, my team started yelling at me about...
About
doing this without them knowing. Yeah. And so I was like, all right. And then things started happening, in like a more controlled manner.
Well, it's funny because we got to know each other in the 2020 way. We started DMing each other on Twitter. That's how you become friends with somebody nowadays.
Yeah, I made a lot of friends this way, Chris, but none as cool as you, or maybe people tied with you, perhaps. But Mina, I was a huge fan of yours. So connecting with you online was a real pleasure. But I grew up a wrestling fan. I remember your debut in WWE and everything you've accomplished. And it's been awesome because you accomplished it through pure talent, merit, hard work. you're like the cream rising to the top in my mind.
Well, I mean, we kind of have similar tales. The fact that you at one point were in the running and now you're actually on the cabinet with Biden to help him with his campaign. I mean, how was it for you to get even to this level? Because, I mean, politics is, I'm assuming, kind of a lot like wrestling. There's a million people that want to do it, but only very few that get to that certain point.
Well, there was more in common than I realized, Chris.
Do tell.
I actually think I appeal to people of every political background because I was talking about problems that, in my mind, have nothing to do with politics. Like the robot trucks don't care what the truck driver thinks, is the problem. And it was a really fascinating experience, Chris, where I'm an entrepreneur by background, and I looked into running for president before declaring. And I thought I had a sense as to what the process would look like, but you never really know until you do it. Just like I'm sure if there was a kid out there who wants to become a professional wrestler, they think they know what it's like, and then they get into the life, and they're like, this is not quite what I thought it was. It's better in some ways, it's worse in others. I think the way that than what you imagine. I think the way it was better for me, and I think a lot of performers can appreciate this, is just the amount of energy and love and gratitude you experience on the trail when, like, you go and there are people that really believe in you and support you. You know, I know for performers, that's like a really profound experience when you meet fans who you mean a lot to, and then you realize, like, wow, people actually believe in me and, like, care about what I'm doing.
Well, I mean, and I guess just to go back to the original question, to get to be a part of, you know, the original, like, debates of eight candidates and all this other stuff, how do you throw your hat into the ring and say, I want to run to be, you know, the Democrat representative for the president of the United States? Like, how does that process all work?
I'd love to unpack this, Chris, because maybe I can inspire someone to run.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And I've been on record now saying I think that a professional wrestler or a former professional wrestler is going to wind up like a serious presidential candidate at some point.
Because
the parallels really are really, really high. So the rules to running for president are very basic, where the only rules are that you have to be a natural born citizen and 35 years or older, which applies to just about everyone, if you think about it.
Right.
Yeah, you could run for president. Sure. So so then the real rules kick in when it comes to raising money and getting attention. Because you need to raise millions and millions of dollars for anyone to take you at all seriously. Mm. And thanks to folks getting behind me and my campaign, we ended up raising enough to compete. We raised about $40 million, all from small donors, really. This, like, from individuals who wanted to improve our way of life. So if you raise enough money and get enough attention, then the media will start covering you. And in my case, I came up through podcasts. It's one reason why I'm happy to join you here today, that if not for podcasts, I never would have gotten the support I needed to get on that stage. The first debate stage threshold was 65,000 donors and 1% in three polls. So that was the goal. And as soon as they set that goal out, Chris, I was like, all right, let's go get 65,000 donors. the toughest thing about the polls was actually getting on the poll. In other words, like, having the pollster put Andrew Yang as an option was actually, like, the biggest concern. But then after we got listed, I thought we could get 1%, and we did.
That's amazing. So I had that before when we were first talking about doing the Chris Jericho cruise. They said, well, we want to get 10,000 people to sign up for this, you know, information list, or would you be interested type thing. I said, how many do you need? We need 10,000. I said, I'll get you 15,000. And what's the deadline? You know, a week and a half from now. And dude, I end up getting 14,900. And they're like, stop, we got it. Like, if you need this number, I'll find the people because I know they're out there. So I'm assuming that's kind of the same way that your attitude was.
Yeah, the measurements were super helpful, because if you have a goal, you feel confident you can hit it, you know, like,
yeah.
And that was our experience. Now, not to say that's an easy thing, like getting 14,000 people to sign up for something, or 65,000 people, like, you need to be doing something that people are excited about. But the debate thresholds were incredibly helpful to me, no doubt about it. And we took full advantage.
Were you surprised at how big and popular and viable your candidacy was? Because right off the bat, you were kind of one of the guys that had personality, and then people, like, I knew your name a year ago when you first started even thinking about all this.
You know, it's if you'd asked me ahead of time, like, did I think that we were going to do well? I honestly thought we were going to do well. I guess you have to have a certain degree of belief or confidence to
get started.
But if you asked me during the campaign, like, hey, can you believe all of this stuff that's happening? I would have been like, no, I can't believe it. Because you can say in the abstract, oh, yeah, we're going to do great. And then you get there, and then there are crowds of thousands of people or folks with a tattoo of your face on their leg or whatnot. Like you don't predict that. And so and you also can't know what that's going to actually feel like when you see it. Like, even if you'd say ahead of time, like, oh, yeah, people will be excited. But then you get there and then people are excited. It's a different experience than anything you've had before.
Tell us about those debates. It's funny because you know you've made it when you are characterized on Saturday Night Live, and when the debates were happening, you were on it, man. How was that to be on SNL?
It was funny. When I saw myself on SNL, I was like, yes. I mean, because the fear, honestly, Chris, was that they just didn't even bother impersonating you. You know what I mean? Like, there was one candidate that wasn't impersonated in the first skit, and they complained about it, and then they brought someone to impersonate them, like, the following week. So I did feel a degree of excitement to be portrayed on SNL by Bowen Yang. And the debates themselves were really transformative in many respects, because like my name recognition shot up immediately after the first couple of debates, where you can feel this, and I think there are some performers that have had this experience, where you go from being able to walk down the street one day and like no one knows who the heck you are, and then like the following week you walk down the street and then like all of a sudden it's like selfie time and you're like, whoa, that's different. That was what those first two debates did.
You know, it's funny because back in the, you know, when we were kids, if you wanted to take a picture with someone, you had to prepare ahead and you had to have your camera and be ready. Nowadays, like you said, everybody's like, hey, I think I recognize that guy. Let's take a selfie. Like, I don't know who you are, but my kid loves you. Can we take a picture? I'm like, nothing better than asking for a favor as you insult me at the same time.
At least Google me before you do this.
Exactly. But you had a lot of interesting platforms. And first of all, the catchphrase was great. Make America Think Again. Explain your mindset behind using that.
Well, it came about through the acronym MATH. I think I've got a MATH cat somewhere. And so I had a joke on the trail where I said the opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian guy who likes math. And everyone always like thought that was really funny. And then someone said, yeah, math is an acronym for Make America Think Harder. And I was like, yeah, Make America Think Harder. So we ended up selling millions of dollars of math caps and math merchandise. And it really was about trying to dig into the real problems. Because to me, Donald Trump got elected because our economy has turned on many, many Americans, including many, many former manufacturing workers in the Midwest. And we have not truly grappled with what this transformation in our economy has actually meant to people in Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, all around the country. I saw the aftermath of these waves of automation in the Midwest, and you have too. And one of the things, so there are groups of people that understand what's going on in American communities more deeply, and that's people who've traveled all over the place. Like I know you have. You've seen this entire country many times over.
Yes.
Same thing with comedians. Comedians, musicians, and professional wrestlers know this country in a different way because you've been to like every market, every mid-sized city, stayed in, you know, hundreds of different hotels and motels. And so you have a sense of what's going on in the country. I got that experience between 2011 and 2017. I ran a national nonprofit that I started called Venture for America, where I traveled around the country. Mm-hmm. And I realized that things were going poorly for more and more people. And I wanted us to think harder about how to solve those problems and not just attack the other side saying like, it's their fault, it's our fault. Like, you know, it goes back to what I was saying before. It's like the robot truck's not going to care about the political beliefs of the trucker. Like Amazon's closing 30% of our stores and malls and paying zero in taxes. Like, that's not a partisan thing. That's just like, my mall closed. I don't have a job anymore. I go home and just order everything on Amazon Prime, but like there's no Main Street business, like no livelihoods. So that's what Make America Think Harder was about, Chris, was trying to dig into the real problems and then propose real solutions.
You mentioned robot trucks a couple times. What are you referring to? Artificial intelligence and robots and obviously the fact that they're going to take jobs from human beings. Explain that a little bit more.
Sure. So the example that just came to pass about 2 weeks ago was that Google announced that they have AI that can do the work of call center workers. They're essentially like, look, stop using call centers, just let Google do it. Uh-huh. And that sounds fantastic if you're a business owner, maybe. But it sounds less fantastic if you're one of the 2 million plus Americans who work in call centers right now, making, $12 to $14 an hour. You're like, huh, Google can all of a sudden do my job by flipping a switch. Mm-hmm. Because they've developed artificial intelligence that can take on that work. So it's call center workers, it's a lot of accounting and bookkeeping, it's increasingly going to be legal work and journalism. eventually it's truck driving because they're working on self-driving trucks right now using AI. And if you think about the reason I raised that industry is that it's the most common job in 29 states, driving a truck. You know, over 3 million truckers, 94% men, average age 48. So if you imagine what that shift is going to look like on the ground for those people and families and their communities, it's devastating. So I was trying to raise attention to the fact that, look, we can argue about bullshit, or we can forecast very clearly what's going to happen to the livelihoods of more and more of us and try and evolve. And that was the message of my campaign.
Because it's a very viable thing, man, when you think about how much, you know, automated services are taking over. I haven't heard about automated trucks. That's actually quite scary, because if you're talking about that, you're also talking about automated cars for Ubers and taxis and, you know, FedEx drivers or whatever it may be. This is something that's going to be a big concern over the next 15, 20 years, because if you look at our cell phones from five years ago, even compared to now, it's a completely different thing. All technology is increasing so rapidly. We're going to get to a point where, like you said, there's a lot of jobs being taken over by robots. What can we do to remedy that, to move forward with it rather than worrying about being against us?
Yeah, there are two basic approaches, Chris. Number one is to try and prevent it. Say, you know, like pass regulations where like you can't have self-checkout, or you can't do things with software and AI. That's a terrible approach, though you are going to see aspects of that in certain fields. For example, I guarantee you that the medical doctor lobby is going to say like, hey, no AI can prescribe drugs or do the things we do. There's going to be like some legal jockeying. And then the second approach, which is the approach that we should take, is to try and share the value that's being generated more quickly and broadly. So if you have a company like Amazon that's worth over $1 trillion, they should be actually putting money back towards the public in a way that just we end up enjoying and allowing us to transition. And that was the basis of my universal basic income, the Freedom Dividend, where everyone gets, I was proposing $1,000 a month, and that would be enough to make a lot of people, you know, feel more secure in their future, but also enable more people to make better transitions in a time when the economy is going to be transforming faster than ever. And the pandemic accelerated all the things I was worried about, because we're seeing 10 years worth of change in 10 weeks
right
now. And if you go to a grocery store now and you see the self-checkout, you're like, well, that's cool. You know, like one less human being for me to interact with. Whereas if you saw that last year, you might have been irritated.
And let's talk a little bit more about that, about your universal basic income. What exactly was it, and how would you plan on introducing it into the economic system currently?
So universal basic income is an idea that has been with us for decades. Thomas Paine was for it. Martin Luther King was for it. Milton Friedman was for it. And it's a plan that just puts a certain amount of money into the hands of every member of a society. In our case, I was proposing every citizen gets $1,000 a month.
From the government?
From the government. And the goal is to build a trickle-up economy where you get this money and then you end up spending it in your town on car repairs and food and daycare expenses and Little League signups and the rest of it. And it ends up going right into the economy, creating jobs and opportunities where you live. So the goal was for us to have a tax that actually harnessed the gains of like the Amazons and Ubers of the world and Netflixes, some of the companies that aren't paying meaningful taxes right now, and then put money into our hands. And the great thing, Chris, is when I started, people were like, wow, that seems very dramatic. But now, as we're having this conversation, 55% of Americans agree that we should have universal basic income now and in perpetuity. And something like 76% of Americans agree that we should have cash relief during the pandemic, including a majority of both parties. So what started out as an idea I had to frankly introduce to people now has mainstream and widespread support, because we're in such a deep, dark hole right now where we sent $1,200 to millions of Americans in April, and it worked. And, you know, it worked great. Like, turns out that money in people's hands was a really good thing. And now millions of Americans are looking up saying, like, we should probably do that more regularly, especially right now when we're still trying to fight this pandemic.
You know, it's funny because you think that the concept of like, well, how much money would that even be? But then we had to do it, like you said, in April when the pandemic hit, and it didn't disrupt the country or put us. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of debt and all that sort of thing. But the idea that you proposed at first to me seems, how in the hell can we do that? But we were forced to do it, like you said, in the middle of this pandemic. So it does prove that it can work.
Yeah. And a very, very small proportion of the $2.2 trillion CARES Act actually went to us. Like the vast, vast majority of that money, like 85, 90%. Went to giant companies to bail them out. It's a lot more expensive to bail out an airline than it is to send people $1,000. So we clearly have the resources, Chris. And again, when the money comes to us, most of us are just going to spend it back in the economy anyway. And Mark Cuban just came out yesterday and said government should be sending everyone $1,000 every 2 weeks with the condition that we spend it. And Mark's a very, very smart businessman. He's looking up saying we need to stimulate demand, because without demand, all of these mom and pop restaurants and small businesses are going to close.
What about the pilot that you wanted to start in New York, or you did start with 20 people getting $500 a month for 5 years?
Yeah, good old Hudson project, Hudson Up. So we're giving that's what the town's called, Hudson, in New York. Not far from where I am right now, actually. And 20 people are getting $500 a month for 5 years. So if you do the math on that, they're going to get $30,000 each over 5 years. JJ Redick, who I think might be someone is one of the funders of it. He's the NBA player, along with Albert Wenger and Susan Danziger. So a number of people have adopted this town in New York, and we're going to start giving out the money pretty soon. So super excited about it. We're hoping to document some of the experiences. And the thing I love about it is the time frame, because if you know you're getting money for 5 years, that's like a long enough time for you to actually make different decisions. Like at first you get money and you obviously just spend it on whatever you need. But then if you know you have a path forward for that long, you might actually make different moves.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So we mentioned earlier that you've been named to Joe Biden's council for small business and entrepreneurship. And how, first of all, exactly what does that entail? And second of all, how is it working with Biden after first running against him in the primaries?
Joe and I have always gotten along well. He's always a good dude, backstage, before the debates, after the debates, even when we were competing. And this is the most impressive thing, like people don't remember this very well, Chris, because now he's the nominee and I'm 100% behind him beating Trump.
Right.
But there were tough times for Joe on the campaign trail early on. Like there were a lot of times when it was not clear that he was going to be the nominee.
Right.
And he always had a great, generous spirit towards me and the people around him, even when things looked really, really rough for him. So he's a very easy guy to work with. And my efforts with the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council, it's really to make the case to small business owners around the country that Joe and Kamala are a better choice and that they have real plans that are going to help small businesses. I'm really passionate about this because I'm an entrepreneur and I ran a small private company myself for years. It's like the bedrock of my career, really. Like I still see myself as that guy more than politician guy or whatever the hell I am. So the council is making the case to small business owners that we need you to succeed, that there's going to be no recovery without small business leading the way. And I believe that in my bones, because if you look at the numbers, or if you look at the reality in any town, like, can you imagine a town that didn't have like small businesses, restaurants, entrepreneurs? Like, you know, the place is a freaking literal like ghost town or, you know, wasteland. Mm-hmm. And it breaks my heart that so many small businesses are hurting right now to the degree they are through no fault of theirs. It's just, you know, if you ran a restaurant, you're not allowed to have as many people in. How the heck are you going to make money? You know, like I talked to a guy, you probably know some of his work, but Jose Andres, who's like a celebrity chef, and, and he says he predict that over half of independent restaurants are going to go out of business in the next number of months without some kind of relief.
It's terrible, like you said, because it is such a strange year of all of these businesses barely hanging or not even being allowed to open. And it's so crazy. Thankfully, you know, we've still been able to work, but so many people haven't been able to work. And it really kind of puts it into perspective just how quickly things can change. And people just don't have anything. They've had this great, like you said, this great career or this great, you know, business. And then it's just all done in the blink of an eye. It really is crazy to see how quickly it all happened.
Now, when I was talking about the automation of jobs and universal basic income, some people thought I was pessimistic. And then this happened and they were like, oh, like, turns out that, there was actually something to that. We need to do a better job of creating a country where people can get what they need. Because right now there are so many folks who are suffering and really facing existential crises where they're going to lose their home, lose their business, aren't sure how they're going to put food on the table. Like we clearly have the resources to do better than this. And we just saw it again, $2.2 trillion, vast majority of which just went straight to big companies, half of which frankly didn't even really need the bailout that badly. I mean, there are some businesses that are doing okay. But you know, what you're seeing is that more of these companies are going to figure out how to do more with fewer people. You know, you have companies like Tyson, the meatpacking giant, that says, like, we're going to replace meatpacking workers with robots because they can't get sick, you know, and you can't really be mad at them about that. So there are some of these businesses that are doing fine on the top line. It's just that people are going to be left behind more and more.
It's amazing how so many of these things that we're talking about were things that were in comic books and in movies in the 60s and 70s, and now it's all coming true. Like you said, like robots working at a meatpacking plant. You know, you and I talking to each other face-to-face via computer, like things. I met George Lucas once and asked him, is it weird for you that all of these things that you put in your movies as fantasy are now becoming reality? And this is literally where we're at this point. Like I said, give another 5-10 years, it's going to be even more automated and more Terminator-esque.
Yeah, so we need to try and accelerate quickly some of the good things as well as some of the not so good things. And it's tough for people because a lot of people don't really have much confidence in government. And I get that. You know, like the government has not really been inspiring a lot of confidence for quite some time. But given the scale of the problems we're looking at, you need government to get its act together. And when I decided to run, there were some people I knew from tech and entrepreneurship who were like, yo, like the government is not like a high efficiency realm. Like, you sure you want to do this? And I said to them, I was like, look, we do not have a choice. Like, you know, when you look at the scale of these problems, you need our government to get its shit together. And so I said, you know, like, I'll do my best, because I knew that we needed it for, I mean, you're a parent. I'm a parent. Your kids are older than mine. Like, you know, you got like real teenagers.
Teenagers. Yes.
But, you know, I knew that we needed to get our act together on a higher level if we're going to pass a country we're at all excited about to our kids.
So do you feel, talking more about Mr. Biden, Joe Biden, his platform for president, it seems a lot of it is Joe Biden, I'm not Trump. Like, people will vote for Joe just because they don't like Trump at all and will just vote for anybody. Does this help your campaign? Does it hurt it? I mean, obviously you want votes, but do you feel people are voting, will vote for Biden for the right reasons or just because they want to get rid of Donald?
Well, Joe won the primaries, I think, in part because people had more confidence that he would draw voters who were sick of Trump.
Right.
You know, like, there were a bunch of us who ran as Democrats, and it seemed like there was like a real move towards a degree of comfort, familiarity, security. And I'm not sure that's bad or wrong. Like, I think at this point, Americans are looking for a degree of reassurance. And Joe is a very familiar figure to many people. He does not strike anyone as terribly extreme or ideological. And I think these are good things for America right now, where you look up and say, this leadership is not working. 72% of Americans think that right now is the worst time we've ever lived, which I'm going to suggest is not a good look if you're like the incumbent. The incumbent, you're like, hey, I'm now presiding over like the worst time anyone's ever.
Worst time ever, ever, like just period?
Yeah, like the worst time that you have ever lived
is this
72% of Americans say right now.
Yeah, not a good look, right?
So this is objectively terrible. And, you know, we're looking for a different approach. I think many Americans are of that mindset and will choose Joe and Kamala as a result. And I think that's good. I know, like, it's to me that this is going to be a positive change.
You think it'll inspire more confidence in the government, or have we gone too far for that at this point?
Well, that to me is the major challenge, Chris, and I may be a part of this, is that if you look at the problems that we've been dealing with, it's not enough anymore to say, like, look, I'm not irrational or erratic, like I'm responsible. You have to actually get the government to work in a way that's going to solve problems and benefit the American people. And a lot of Americans don't feel that right now. So the fear I would have is that no matter who's in office, that confidence in government continues to deteriorate, and then we'll never get anything done. And so that's not about winning elections. That's actually about getting government to work more effectively, and it needs help. You know, and that's one of the things that I think I may be able to help with. So there are a couple of, one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about universal basic income, or getting cash into people's hands, is that would work and the government can do it. You know what I mean? Like, if the government stands up, or like, let's say I'm an official and I tell you about my plans and promises, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, or maybe I'll get them done, maybe I won't. But if I say I'm going to get money to you, like, we can do that.
Right.
And I'm very, very confident that the money will actually benefit you tremendously. It'll like benefit you more than just about anything else I'm going to tell you I'm going to do. So that's one thing that I believe would actually fundamentally increase people's confidence and faith in government. And I know this because they've done this in Alaska for decades and it works there. But anytime this happens, people actually have a much more positive attitude about the government, because it seemed like the government was actually looking out for them, did something real for you, made you able to make better decisions for yourself. And then you're like, oh, I actually kind of believe in these guys now. Like that to me is like the big move that if we make, it can actually increase people's confidence pretty quickly.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
All right, Andrew, you're a big wrestling fan and you tweet about it all the time. But what surprised me recently was how vocal you've been about the way WWE treats their talent and why you want to change that. What made you become so vocal about this issue?
Someone sent me the WWE contract. It is very, very long and robust. Like, it's a very long contract. the amount of control that the WWE has is incredibly high. It has made them or saved them tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars over the life of the company. And that money came directly from the pockets of the performers.
It's interesting because you hit so many points to speak about, because I think a lot of it, that what you just described, is exactly the truth. But for us in the business, it's just the way it is.
And I don't begrudge any wrestler from signing that deal, any deal really, because WWE is a quasi-monopoly, essentially. You know, you work for years in the hopes of being able to do what you love in front of millions of people for a living. You know, no matter what that contract said, you're going to sign it.
Mm-hmm, exactly. You know,
like you don't have like real bargaining power, particularly, you know, if you're just trying to, you know, make a living in the business. And so this is really a failure of government to look out for the talent. on this side. And I'm friendly now with, you know, a number of performers, and they message me. I mean, and like that's how I got this contract and other things, where they're sick of the bullshit. but there's no way they can like actually raise their hand and be like, hey, Vince, like, you know, like this is messed up.
Exactly.
And, you know, because the power dynamic, you know, it's so uneven. So it's something that I would love to help the talent with, because it's the right thing to do. It's been overdue for years and decades. And the numbers, since I'm a numbers guy, I mean, WWE is worth like $3.3 billion. Vince is himself a billionaire. I mean, this is well past the point where you could make any kind of like dollars and cents cost-based argument about this. Like at this point, this is just the McMahons hoarding wealth. They could afford easily to treat the talent in a more fair and legal manner. They just choose not to do so.
So how could you help them if you were put in a position to?
It's fun. I mean, so if we win, I'm going to be in a position where I can call up the Secretary of Labor, or in this case, it's the National Labor Relations Board, and then bring suit against WWE and say, like, hey, I think you're misclassifying your employees here. And the damages then would be really significant. So that is more or less the plan. We may need to have some brave performer or ex-performer come forward and say, look, here are the practices. And I have been contacted by folks who are like, you know, look, I believe in this, and I'm at a point in my career where they can't really do anything to me anyway. So you know, let's have at this. Because customarily for a National Labor Relations Board action, it typically has to be an employee that initiates. So that is one of the trickier elements of this, Chris. But I'm very confident we can get there, because there are a lot of people that recognize that this is wrong and it's been going on for far too long.
In my opinion, this really does have to change. And this is no ill will towards the WWE. It's just the way it is. Like you just said, all of these things, you know, the fact even that they can show all of my matches on their network that people pay for and I don't get a dime of a royalty, it makes no sense. It's not how normal business, normal entertainment, the normal world works.
Yeah, exactly. You should be getting residuals. Like that, there's a, you know, one of the things that someone's raised is that Screen Actors Guild protections are really significant. I mean, you can see how like the, you know, the Hollywood folks get treated.
Yeah.
and a lot of performers actually would qualify for a Screen Actors Guild by the basis that you're on TV, you have lines, like you show up, like, you know, I mean, the ratings of wrestling shows are higher than just about any other show on TV. So like, you know, and you're like telling a performer, you're, you know, getting a script, like you do your thing. So I agree with you, Chris, that we're going to need to exert pressure from the TV networks, from different directions, because the thing that infuriates me is that, like, you can't expect people to martyr themselves. You know what I mean? Like, you can't expect someone to be like, hey, I'm now going to jeopardize a career I spent decades building. And they know that they'll get blackballed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they'll get blackballed for some nonsense reason. They'll be like, oh, you know, like just wasn't a fit anymore or whatever it was. Like, you know, that's going to go down.
Right.
So the job is, we have to make it easy for folks to step forward and say, look, like they should do the right thing. And in America, money talks, you know? So if it's the TV network saying like, look, the administration is saying to us that we're essentially like, you know, facilitating the exploitation of your workers,
yeah,
by airing your product, and like, you know, we should have a tough conversation about this. The hope, Chris, is that they see the writing on the wall and they step forward and say, you know what, we're going to start doing the right thing. Because like that beats getting dragged to a kicking and screaming. You know, if you get dragged to a kicking and screaming, the talent will see and be like, wow, they really did not want to give us our fair due.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different ways to get there, but I'm confident we can get there under Joe and Kamala, because it's funny, and this is true for wrestling, I know, where it's like you've been in the industry for a certain period of time, like you get to know everyone just because like you've been in that locker room, and you know, it's like different eras cross over. The same is true in politics. Like I was out there campaigning, And like now I can get to anyone in like, you know, one or two phone calls pretty straightforwardly. So we're going to get this done. Like this is no joke.
Well, so this is something that you're really wanting to get into. This is something you want to take care of and change.
It's a terrible message to people because I grew up a fan. It's like a terrible message to grow up a wrestling fan and then over time realize like, wait a minute, yeah. Like, you know, like some of these folks are like really getting injured. Some of these folks are like, you know, passing away early, like, you know, in part because they're under these pressures to perform because of like the nature of their relationship where you know, don't have any real protections. It's actually, to me, like there's this real arc of disillusionment that I think a lot of fans have. And, you know, I'm going to apply this to something else too. Like, I think high-level NCAA athletes should get paid because they're making hundreds of millions of dollars for their institution. The coaches are getting paid millions of dollars. Like, the highest paid public employee in the state of Connecticut, I think, is, like, the UConn, like, basketball coach or something like that. You know, like that. And then these like, the talent, the general message is that the talent should get paid what they deserve. Mm-hmm. And so if it's NCAA athletes, it's like, look, you know, if people are buying your jersey and like playing you in a video game, like, you know, maybe you should get a little bit of that because, you know, like that, things like that.
Well, you do get royalties for that, whether, you know, whatever the percentage of that is. But what we're talking about that really gets to me, like I said, like I did a movie called MacGruber 10 years ago. I was in it for 2 minutes. I still get residual checks. They're not a lot. $20, $15, you know, $50. But I'm still getting residuals from being on that movie. Here I am with probably 100 matches on the network and getting nothing. I don't see the fairness in that, if that's the right word.
That's the right word. And great job in MacGruber, too. That's a classic film.
Thanks, man. I got my $27 the other day from it.
Still, it's like a reminder. You know what my parallel is in that, Chris? Like, I've written a couple books.
Right.
And one of the books is getting translated into different languages. It's up to like maybe like 10,
nice.
10 languages.
What's it called?
And whatnot. The War on Normal People. It's about some of the automation trends gotcha. That you and I were talking about and the need to evolve. But I get random royalty checks from like, you know, some other country, some other publisher, and like it's not big money, but damn if it doesn't feel great. You know,
yeah.
Like where someone sent you money, be like, wow, like the Dutch publisher to send me, you know, like $500, like that's great.
Yeah, but that's the point. And plus, and not only is it great to get this mailbox money, as I like to call it, but it also shows that there is royalties owed to you, owed to me from everywhere, countries all over the world, whether it is only $50 or $500, they should still be, those checks should still be coming in.
There is so much value associated with your matches on the WWE Network. Like, mm-hmm. if you had to put a dollar value on that, Chris, it's a whole lot more than MacGruber money. I'll tell you that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
like, you should be getting, like, 4- and 5-digit checks on the regular for that, given how much money they're generating.
Well, I think we should have a conversation after. I'll tell you that right now.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
As we start to wind down, there's a couple more things I want to talk about. First of all, we've talked a lot about wrestling. How did you get into wrestling? Did you used to go to the matches when you were a kid? Who were your favorites to watch? That sort of thing.
So I was born in 75. So that means like I was in like elementary school with like WrestleMania,
right.
Like 1, 2, and 3. And WrestleMania 3 was like the big kickoff for me. It was Macho Man against Ricky Steamboat.
Yeah, classic.
Like that match. And so then we went to WrestleMania 4, like those like one of those closed circuit viewings with my dad and my brother. We went to live shows, so I saw Andre the Giant in person. And the rest of it. So I grew up a big fan, and I had that arc I was talking about where it's like, you're like, wow, this is awesome. And then eventually you're like, wait a minute, like, you know, like some of these guys, like, seem to be like going through very, very difficult times. And you start looking at how they're treated. So I think I got into wrestling at a time when, frankly, you know, I feel like it would have been hard not to get into wrestling where mm-hmm. you know, you grew up in that era. And then there was that other that other surge in popularity in like the 90s with like the NWO and like the waning days of the Monday Night Wars. Those were good times. I think like it's like my childhood and then like, you know, we had some fun and then you come back. And to me, the parallels between wrestling and politics are very real, Chris. I'll tell you that. Like, because you travel the country, you get in front of groups of relative strangers, you try and like, you know, like inspire them or like, right. entertain them in your case. But like that, there's like a degree of it. And so my appreciation for what you all do has been high really my entire life. And the athleticism, the training, the trust, you know, you have mm-hmm. to like trust the person you're in the ring with and the rest of it. There's just a lot of humanity to pro wrestling. You know, I think that anyone who pays any attention to it realizes that like the investment you all make is profoundly higher than in any other field outside of, I can't even really think of many others. Really, it might be like the highest investment field there is.
Yeah. Well, and I agree with you on that. I always thought it was cool that, you know, that you were a politician, you know, a presidential possible candidate that was tweeting about wrestling and congratulations to Cody Rhodes and congratulations to AEW and congratulations to Chris Jericho. And I was like, that's really cool.
Oh, I would love to hear a bit about AEW because and talent has, you know, that they let me know that like they feel well treated at AEW. And I have natural sympathies for AEW because it seems like the scrappy upstart that is more sensitive to how talent gets treated, trying to go against like the Goliath or Juggernaut in the form of WWE. And I think any wrestling fan knows that some degree of competition is positive for the talent.
Just
that you know that there are actual like options. So those are the things that immediately made me like AEW, but would love to hear about your experience there.
Well, I think the biggest difference is kind of what we've been talking about this whole conversation is that WWE treats the business as a wrestling business because that's what it's been for 60 years from Vince's father and Vince's grandfather, almost from the old school carny attitude. And you can see that with, you know, the independent contractor, for example. It's not right, but it's just the way it is, like I explained. AEW treats things from a sports team perspective. The Khan family owns the Jacksonville Jaguars. They own the Fulham Football Club in England. So they treat the company like they treat their football team. And that's a whole different vibe as how the talent, the athletes, the performers get treated right off the bat. The thing, you know, not to get into total specifics, but things that I have here in AEW, I never had in WWE for 20 years. Even something as simple as paying your expenses on the road, like any team does. If the Jaguars go to play a game in, you know, St. Louis, the hotel is paid for, and here's the trip, and here's the team bus to pick you up and drive you around. That's just the way it is. It's not even a second thought, right? That's how it is here in AEW as well, which it's never like that in WWE. They still go with, here's your plane ticket, you're flying to Detroit, you're working Detroit, Chicago, Cape Girardeau and St. Louis. So you rent your car in Detroit, you drop it off in St. Louis, you got to find your hotel rooms, you got to get a car that's got a good rate for the drop off, all this stuff. And those are your expenses and your responsibility to do that. And that's another thing that I think people just like, are you kidding me? You really have to do
that's
that?
That's nuts.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. That's the biggest difference.
That's a pretty big difference. But I think what you said is right on about kind of like the lens that people have from different backgrounds. Like if you're used to owning an NFL team, you just look up and say, well, of course we're going to pay for
why that, we have to. That. Yeah, exactly. You know, to me, it's one of those things where I'm really glad that we were able to take a chance and get this company off the ground and make it successful. And I have no intentions of ever going anywhere ever again. I like it here. I like working for the Khan family. And it's been a lot of fun, which sometimes it was not as fun in WWE. So it's definitely a whole different vibe here.
Well, AEW's success is just a good thing for the industry, for the talent, for performers. So I'm a fan of the new organization. We're going to make some changes for the talent in WWE. I keep harping on WWE because, like, they really are the behemoth of the industry.
Sure,
like they gobble up the vast majority of the value. Like a lot of these marketplaces are like this. The UFC is the same in MMA, where like there's a bit of a winner take all dynamic. And so the more you can introduce genuine options, genuine competition, it's positive. And the more you can get fair treatment of workers in organizations that have reached a certain point, it's just the right thing to do.
You know, obviously, like you said, you're a wrestling fan, but you use a little bit of that personality to entertain your fans, the Yang Gang, which is the best name ever, by the way. That's a t-shirt. You crowd surf, you do funny viral videos, all this sort of stuff. How important is that for you to show that side of your personality?
I was just competing, Chris, where, you know, I certainly couldn't out politician the politicians. And so I was like, well, like, what do I have going for me? It's like, well, I think I'm like still a fairly normal guy. And I even would like, I prefer to have a good time on the trail than not. And so when you're with your team, and you know this too, it's like you're on the road all the time, like you're in a rental vehicle. In your case, it'd be with maybe a couple of other wrestlers. It's like going from place to place. It's the same as a candidate where you're going, it might be worse for the candidate because I'm in the rental car with folks that work for me. So imagine on both sides, for them, it's like, oh crap, I'm stuck in this rental car with my boss for like hours right. at a time. And then for me, I'm like, oh crap. I'm like, you know, like I can't be a jackass because, you know, it's like I'm going to like ruin the morale of this entire trip. So when you're in that boat that you're just like trying to find fun in things, you're just like, all right, let's just have a good time. And then those videos ended up catalyzing additional support for the campaign. And so then being, you know, like a competitor and an entrepreneur, you're like, all right, like if that's working, like let's do more of that. So I found myself leaning into my humanity more because it was actually a competitive advantage. I feel like most politicians have so much in the way of guardrails around them where you're not even sure they're human sometimes. You're like, oh, is this really your jam? And they have entire teams around them too that are telling them, it's like, look, keep it in bounds, keep it in bounds. But one thing I was grateful for, Chris, is that like because of the vibe of my campaign, like I could act like a person and then everyone would be like, oh, that's just Yang, you know, whereas like if another politician did some of the things I did, they'd be
right. You don't have to be a stiff, you know, non-personable guy to run for candidacy. That's the thing I like about it. You can have some fun, you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't have had it any other way. And there's like a lot of enthusiasm around our campaign to this day for the fact it was like a different approach to politics. And I just think so many Americans are rightfully tired of the way politics is like turning us against each other. Like it just doesn't need to be that way.
Right, you know? Absolutely.
Like we generally have a sense as to what we could do to make things better for ourselves, for our families. Like, you know, we could disagree on the margins, but like most people kind of have a sense as to where we should go. And the divisions are really just being put up by folks who benefit from us getting mad at each other all the time, you know, and that's to some extent politicians, to some extent various media companies. I've met now tens of thousands of Americans in real life. And when you just stand there and talk to someone one-on-one, 99% of the time, they are perfectly reasonable. They're perfectly nice. you know, you could like, not letting you agree on most things has been my experience.
Last thing I want to ask you about is just kind of hit on it, social media. And you mentioned you have younger children. I have teenagers. And there's so much social media use amongst the kids. Negative effect, possibly emotionally, psychologically. Do you feel the government needs to step in a little bit more and regulate this? You know, do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, I think you might have seen that Netflix documentary yes. just came out, The Social Dilemma.
Yes.
Yeah. The data is real. It is clear that our kids' mental health is being reduced by social media. We're seeing record high levels of anxiety and depression among teenage girls in particular. And the government needs to do something about it because as a parent, you're outgunned. Like it's you on one side being like, hey, you know, try and get some outdoor time. And on the other side is like a, you know, two-thirds of a trillion-dollar tech company with the smartest engineers in the country just trying to, like, you know, use a supercomputer as a dopamine delivery device like on your kids. It's like, is that a fair fight? You know, and like, and the tech company is going to generate tens of billions of dollars this year on like revenue. And then the government's like, nothing to see here because our government is just way behind the curve on these issues. So we need to get the social media companies under control where they have their ad revenue and engagement metrics on one side, but then we have our kids' mental health on the other side. And there needs to be a better balance. Right now, our kids' mental health is nowhere in the picture. And this is something that I would love to change. This stuff's real. Like you said before, it's like all the science fiction stuff we read about, it's real today. Like it is real today. But our government is stuck back in the 70s or 80s and acting like it's 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to evolve and advance. I'm for creating a new set of rules and regulations around use of social media for young people in particular. But it's not good for us, Chris. You know, as a parent too, you see it.
Yeah.
And I sense for a lot of reasonable people too, it's like you feel like you don't want to be like a fuddy-duddy being like, oh, you know, these devices these days that they're like screwing up our kids, blah, blah, blah. But these devices these days are screwing up our kids. There's nothing wrong with just like pointing out. It's like the data is clear. So at what point do you do something about it?
And what could you do?
There's a guy that was actually in that documentary, Tristan Harris, whom I'm friends with. He has a Center for Humane Technology where he has a whole set of different design choices that you would make for social media apps. It would reduce their ad revenue. But it would make our kids happier. Mm-hmm. So there are different design choices you can make, Chris, that right now the companies would never make on their own because they're just trying to, you know, maximize revenue. So you need to have some regulations on them that they're not going to like at first, but then after they adopt them, you know, they'll be fine. They'll make a little less money, you know, like that's life. But the one of the reasons why I know this they'll be fine is that a lot of their employees are parents now, and they're worried about what they're doing to their kids. Like they're, you know, they're human beings and parents too. And they're looking around, being like, you know what, like we might have taken this a little too far. So they just need some help getting some rules on the books, and then everyone will be better off.
Last question for you, man. Who's your favorite wrestler, and what's your favorite match that you ever saw?
You know, I still have to go back to Macho Man. Steamboat is my favorite match because it was just so formative and, like, you know, kind of made me a fan. My favorite wrestler of all time, the first person that jumps to mind for me is Macho Man Randy Savage. I just love that guy. anything he did. I was such, like, when he was the WWE champion, I was a kid, and I was like, this is the greatest. Then when he lost it back to Hogan, I was so upset for days and days.
That's great, man. It's funny.
But there are a lot of other performers. Yeah, but there are a lot of other performers I'm a huge fan of, too. And it's great talking to you, man. Really, like, you know, I've been following you for this point. Not to date you or whatnot, but it's been obviously, like, you know, decades.
Yeah, 30 years in the business.
That's incredible, man. Like, you must take excellent care of yourself, you know.
I think I'm just pickled in vodka right now at this point.
Well, it's working. Whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
Well, dude, it's been great talking to you, man. I'm glad we're able to arrange this, and next time we'll have to do it face to face, and I feel that we're gonna have more interactions in the future for sure.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, may this be the first of many conversations, Chris. A big admirer of yours, and so glad that we could have that conversation about the way talent should be treated. Mm-hmm. This is not going to be the last that people hear of this. Like, I'm a man of action first and foremost. And if I'm in position to take action, which I believe I will be, I will.
All right. Love it, man. Well, if you need some help, you know who to call.
I will. Yeah. I'll call you for sure, Chris.
Thanks, man. Have a great day, man.
You too. Have a great weekend.